Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So if you have an apple and I have an apple and we trade apples, we will each still have one apple. But if you have an idea and I have an idea and we exchange ideas, then each of us will have two ideas. That idea, credited to George Bernard Shaw, all rights reserved, is one of the basic building blocks that make up the argument for a stronger creative commons. That is, that more of our intellectual history of ideas and inventions should be held for the common good. That, of course, is a controversial idea with today's contentious intellectual property debates. And it also gets to the heart of a new book called Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership by Lewis Hyde, which takes a historical look at how we've dealt with intellectual property held in common and what those past examples can tell us about the Internet age. Lewis, thanks very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
For starters, and maybe this is a stupid question, but how do you define property?
Well, there are two definitions that I use in the book. The common one that we all sort of intuitively understand is that if you own property, you can exclude somebody else from it. So I have a house and I can keep you out. That means it's my property. But a second definition is that property is a right of action. That is, I have rights connected to my house. I can paint it or sell it and so forth. But once you begin to think about rights, it opens up a wide field so that, for example, I might have the right to share something or give it away. So I think of property as a bundle of rights of action, the things you can do.
And I know we have many listeners, artists, inventors, et cetera, who are engaged every day in the process of creating. So listeners, call in. What do you think the copyright laws should be on what you create? At what point can someone else use your idea or your artwork or whatever else you create as part of their own work? What do you think you owe to the society or to the people who inspire you? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And, Lewis, your book is largely historical, and you go back to the founding fathers. Intellectual property is codified in the Constitution, isn't it?
Well, the Constitution gives Congress the right to create patents and copyright, yes. But the important point about the founding fathers is that they thought of these tools as monopoly privileges, and they were very cautious about monopolies. In general, they thought that knowledge should be the common property of mankind, and then they made some short-term exceptions that allowed people to have monopoly privileges.
And I think it was 28 years, is that right?
Yeah, the first copyright law followed what they'd done in England. You had 14 years of monopoly, and if you were still around, you could get another 14. So 28 years was the old limit.
And then?
And then it went into the public domain. And in fact, the public domain almost was created by such laws. That is to say, in earlier centuries, knowledge, particularly printed knowledge, was controlled by the state. Printers were given monopolies, and it was part of press control. And so in a funny way, the invention of copyright was also the invention of the commons. Because you gave a short-term privilege, you therefore released everything after those years, and anybody could use it without having to figure out who originally made it.
Today's intellectual property copyright laws are more like the life of the artist plus 70 years, correct?
Yes, and for corporations, it's 95 years. And people have pointed out that statistically, these long, long terms are almost indistinguishable from a perpetual copyright, which was something the founders would have been astounded by.
But a lot of creative people will argue, well, why shouldn't it be that way? Why should I give up the rights to the book I write or the music I record or the movie I make at any time? Why does this become public property?
Well, I've written 300 pages on this. But to say it very briefly, first of all, I am not against these short-term monopoly privileges. I think they're very useful. My book is copyrighted. I own it, and I care about that. But the problem is to figure out the balance. And once you get up to a perpetual copyright, which is what we almost have, you begin to gum up a lot of other things. You begin to inhibit the circulation of knowledge. And I'll give you, there are five or six reasons why the term should end, but I'll give you one simple one, which is that you know, all creators take from the commons as well. You know, my book is based on a tremendous amount of reading of other people's work, and so we always build on other people's things. We take from the commons, and there's a wonderful line of Benjamin Franklin's about why he never took a patent on his inventions, and he said, you know, he had benefited so much from things that others had invented from the past that he was happy to give his things away. So there's in a sense, an ethical question raised by how creativity itself operates.
On our Facebook page, Caesar writes, the fair use laws have really changed things. I have mixed emotions about them. Fair use means that the media, for example, can excerpt from other media as long as it's a relatively small amount. I think we can use two-minute excerpts from other news media, for example, on this show to launch discussion. And the writer says, I've been on both sides. A company took footage from a TV series I produced and used it in a DVD release that claims that rock music is satanic, even using my name as a DVD extra in their ads. On the other hand, I am about to begin work on a documentary on Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and plan to use the fair use laws to use footage of the pundits for analysis. So does Caesar's ambivalence or his experiences on both sides of it speak to something important here?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's a wonderful work been done for documentary filmmakers clarifying fair use, which is a very useful tool in this regime of laws. You know, fair use, as you say, lets you use things without having to ask anybody's permission, without having to pay fees. And it's one of the ways that we square the First Amendment with the fact that we give people monopoly control. And so documentary filmmakers are wonderfully on both sides of this. They care about their income, but they also need to use work. And sometimes they need to use it critically. They need to be able to say things that if somebody else controlled the speech, they would not be allowed to say. So in a way, ambivalence is the right response to many of these questions. And then the puzzle is to inform ourselves about the arguments on both sides so as to begin to clarify the ambivalence.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Michael in California. You're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you? Thanks
All right.
for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm a creative director, and I've been working as a graphic designer for about 20 years, and I've worked at a number of different agencies. And from time to time, some agencies, they get upset if you use images of your own work that you've produced on your own professional portfolio site, which, you know, as a creative professional, it's important to have to be able to represent your work and your talents and abilities and so forth. So I'd like to ask your speaker kind of what he thinks about the practice of certain agencies making employees, as a part of their employment agreement, sign away the rights they have as the creator of the work to show images of that work on their own site, not to compete against that agency, but to market their own abilities and skills.
It's a wonderful question. And so an important distinction here is between corporations and individuals. And individual artists get certain rights and corporations get certain rights. When you work for a corporation, typically you lose your rights because you do what's called work for hire. And the argument in favor of that is they do things for you. They give you health insurance and a steady paycheck and stuff. But you don't own your work. The corporation owns it. And in a funny way, you know, one thing that maybe we should think about is maybe we should have different rules of the road for corporate creations and for individual creations. So the tension you're feeling is accurate in some way. You need to be able to figure out how to separate the individualist part of your labors from the part that's been hired.
Can you give us an example, other than Benjamin Franklin, of a creative common that worked and that ran successfully and that still gave people the incentive to create and be able to make a living?
Well, sure. In the book, I talk, for example, about the Human Genome Project, which was successfully done, the description of the human genome, as a common project internationally. A lot of science operates this way. And scientists, there was recently a piece in the New York Times about research done on Alzheimer's. Scientists understand that you need low barriers to the circulation of knowledge if you're going to have complicated scientific problems solved. And examples are all around us. I use Franklin because he did the same thing with his investigations into electricity. But a lot of scientific work proceeds the same way. The incentive question is puzzling because Monopoly privileges do give an incentive, but they also incentivize other things like bullying behavior.
So in your opinion, do we need to differentiate between ideas? Let's say we look at someone who's creating a seed that is more resistant to bugs, someone producing a major motion picture, someone developing a new AIDS drug. Are they all in the same category, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, what you're doing is granulating this, breaking it down into examples, and that, in a way, is what you have to do. I mean, the seed example, you know, again, I am not against patenting. There's some questions about patenting things you find in nature. And then, for example, you'd have to ask, was this an invention that was based on traditional knowledge, in which case maybe it should be left in the commons? You know, partly what my book tries to do is to clarify the ideas that are in play in this. And in those cases, one question would be, what was common to begin with, and where is the inventive step? And then how long does the person or the corporation have control over what they've invented?
Mm-hmm. So in our last 45 seconds, is there a number that you would arrive at? I mean, if the founders of the country had it as 14 years plus another 14 years renewable if you're still alive, and current law has it your life plus 70 years. Do you have a number?
I do. I think copyright, for example, could run lifetime or 50 years, whichever is longer. But the bottom line is, I think we've gone too far, as many people do. We need to figure out how to rebalance this.
Lewis Hyde has written Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. Thank you so much for having this discussion with us.
Thank you for talking with me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, during the fall election season, we'll be doing a few projects that could use your help and investigative chops. If you want to be part of the action on our Election 2010 crowdsourcing team, just go to our show page and give us your email address, and we'll be back in touch soon with more information. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show.